people who are skeptical perhaps about abolishing ICE, or, you know, just imagining what this country would have been like without DHS. And we want to tell the story of how at some point there was no DHS, at some point there was no ICE. And the reason why we're here was because of literally homeland insecurity, right? People who in this country who became so afraid after 9/11. And, you know, in some ways, I myself was an undocumented immigrant, now a DACA recipient, you know, became the enemy for an agency that now has turned all of their power and all of their, you know, really their focus on people like myself instead of really focusing on real threats like COVID. COVID-19 really showed that now DHS, you know, instead of really focusing on what could be real threats to the homeland, ended up focusing on people like me. So I unpacked that history. We have released the first
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will link to your new podcast, Erica Andiola, Chief Advocacy Officer for ACES Action, her new podcast, Homeland Insecurity. And thanks so much to Ryan Devereaux of The Intercept. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on Wednesday. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
And thank you, Sonia. Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland talking at you from my home in the Monta Villa neighborhood of Southeast Portland. How is everybody feeling out there this morning? Difficult times we are having. And if you are a regular consumer of media like I am, a lot of very distressing things going on. So I'm here by myself this morning, and I'd like to just give out the number right away, 503-231-8187. I've got some things on my mind. I'd like to know what's on your mind. But the first order of business, as you most likely know, we had to cancel our regular spring membership drive, and we've been sort of doing it just by these announcements by the hosts and DJs and board ops as we go along with our programs. It's usually around the first week or middle of April, and that's the lifeblood of our station, our membership drives. Obviously, we, being a listener-sponsored station, we do depend upon you, the listeners, support. So if you are a regular listener to Democracy Now!, to talk radio from 8 to 9 a.m., and other morning public affairs programming especially, and of course all other music and information and cultural programming here on this station. And you can afford to send some money our way, especially if you're not currently a member, and especially if you've never contributed before to KBOO, please do consider doing so now. We really need and value your support. Go to kboo.fm, click on donate, or you can snail mail, since the postal service is still going but under threat, and we should use it. You can send your donation by check or money order. Cash, probably not the best way. To our street address. We are getting it at the post office because our station is largely closed, but we will get it. So send it to 20 KBOO Community Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Or if you have access to the internet, which a large percentage, but not everybody does, go to kboo.fm. And of course, while you're there, check out all our archive programming and all the other information that is available on our website. So, what do you want to talk about? 503-231-8187. That's the number. Sonia's standing by at the board to take your call and to transmit it through our magical box and put you on the air. So, yeah, White House advisor Kevin Hassett said that he went viral over the weekend for referring to American workers as human capital stock. I'm reading from the Vox article. Of course, there's many articles. A racially charged, dehumanizing turn of phrase that conjured up images of livestock. And of course, as you just heard, one of Amy Goodman's guests, an African-American man who's talking about the latest atrocities committed by police forces in this country, you know, said that it brought up immediately his ancestors being truly human capital stock. And our human capital stock is ready to get back to work, Hassett told CNN's Dana Bash on Sunday as part of his argument that the U.S. economy is poised for a quick turnaround, even as he acknowledged that the unemployment rate will linger in double figures through November's election. So I'm just wondering how you're doing and how you're feeling. Are you currently not going to a job because of COVID-19? Are you having to go to a job because it's considered essential or just because it's available to you and you need to work? And how are you feeling about that? Those are some questions that are on most people's minds. How is your housing situation? Are you renting? Are you having trouble paying rent? Are you perhaps participating in the rent strike? How are you feeling about all that? 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I've got some other things I wanted to talk about. We've got an election coming up. Well, we just had an election here. Do you want to talk about that? There's some interesting things. Obviously, Wheeler is in a runoff with Sarah Iannarone. Chloe Udaly is in a runoff with Mingus Maps. And Loretta Smith and Dan Ryan are in a runoff coming up in November. And there are some interesting wins. Mike Schmidt won the district attorney, considered a progressive reformist candidate as part of a small but significant trend of people focusing on district attorney elections, both as candidates and as campaigns, to get people who are not into locking so many people up and into challenging the systemic racism of the criminal injustice system. So that's an interesting thing. Of course, our first Latina woman was elected to the city council. And I believe our first Vietnamese American was elected to a statewide office. I'm probably wrong about that, but I'll get the name wrong. I don't have it right in front of me. Someone will call in undoubtedly. I actually voted for them. Pardon me. Those are things I want to talk about. Trump sees a rigged election ahead. Democrats see a constitutional crisis in the making. That's, the presidential election. The president is, he's got this whole Twitter controversy now. He was, for the first time, actually called out by Twitter for his latest tweet on saying that there's a massive possible election fraud if we go to all-mail balloting. Of course, there are issues with access in terms of mail-in balloting, especially for Native American, rural Native American communities on reservations, many of whom don't have street addresses. But of course, that might actually be a fixable problem if we actually had a national focus and strategy to make our elections more fair and accessible, which of course we're going in the opposite direction with Trump. And I personally think that he's saying all these things, as you know, the Republicans traditionally do, and I'm not exonerating the Democrats because they've been actively colluding in a lot of the same voter suppression that the Republicans have been sort of leading the charge on. But they tend to blame the victim, as it were, blame the, you know, the people who are most affected by voter suppression for actually supposedly engaging in voter fraud, whereas voter fraud is a very little practiced thing. I mean, it's something that obviously has to be taken into consideration, especially if the fraud has to do with gerrymandering districts and taking large numbers of people of color off the voting rolls and other such shenanigans. And and also in Florida, I noticed that there was a small positive step that the courts have negated for now, the Florida law, which attempted to impose, say that all the convicted felons who had by a referendum had been given their right to vote back, that they had to pay all their outstanding fines before they could actually vote. So we'll see how that plays out. Florida, of course, always being a key state in federal elections over the past several decades, not starting with, but possibly most prominently with the Gore election in 2000. Trump calling out supposedly rigged elections means that there's probably a lot of rigging going on behind the scenes, and most certainly more in his favor than in his opponent. Of course, we could also talk at length about Joe Biden and some of his recent strange statements and more generally. But I'd like to hear what you have to talk about. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Call in early. And if you've never called in, I'd really, really like to hear from you. Or if you're a less frequent caller, I would like to hear from people who we don't often hear from on KBOO, Portland being obviously a majority white city. We do tend to hear from that demographic. It's always interesting. It would be interesting to hear from people from other demographics. We'd also tend to hear mostly from men. It'd be nice to hear from more women. 503-231-8187. Got anyone up, Sonia?
We have Harry on the line. Go ahead, Harry. You're on the air.
Oh, greetings, Paul, and thank you for taking my call. I'd like to discuss the coronavirus that's going on. Of course, it hit the 100,000 death mark today, or was it yesterday? So if you see, we've been closed down for 3 months, so March, April, and May, and 100,000 people died. That's 1,000 people a day. And they still don't have a vaccine. And if this keeps up, 1,000 people a day, by the end of this year, that's like 300,000 people. So, you know, so we still have this issue going on. They're opening the states little by little. I don't know if you caught it yesterday. They opened the New York Stock Exchange, but of the people, and only 25%.
Got to keep the stock exchange open.
Yes, yes. 25% of the capacity only, But anyone who goes to the New York Stock Exchange, they have to sign a waiver that they're not liable if they catch the virus.
Yep.
So that was kind of scary there. So, and here's the even another scarier part. One of the podcasts I listen to is called The David Pakman Show. And mm-hmm. yesterday they had a segment in there that they, if they came out with the virus for the coronavirus, a vaccine for it, right, 72% of Democrats will take it, but only 44% of Republicans will take it. And this is going to cause, you know, talking about culling the herd, I mean, this is, you know, a lot of this is caused by, there's a lot of anti-viral vaccination people out there. So that's why it's only 72% of Democrats will do it. But the idea that, you know, even though if we came up with a virus, a vaccine today, here's 54% of Republicans won't take it. This is horrible.
Well, maybe that would even the playing field, since obviously people of color are dying at a wildly disproportionate rate because of lack of access to medical care and historical, difficulty getting medical insurance and all those factors that we heard about on Democracy Now! In the last hour. But obviously that's not something we would wish for, but it is interesting. It's a really, really crazy time. I just pulled up an article by Tom Hartman, the next death wave from coronavirus will be poor, rural, and white, which is based upon obviously the fact that there's this massive rush to so-called open up and to congregate in large numbers largely in that demographic, and a lot of those demonstrations we still, I think, have yet to see if there's going to be spikes based upon some of those demonstrations that happened with these so-called liberate demonstrations. But yeah, it's a crazy situation out there.
Yeah, about 1,000 people a day are dying. That's the average now. So we'll see what happens. But people, they want to get out there. They, you know, being hunkered down, you know, into your house like this, and people want to get out and everything else. But, you know, just wait a few months. I mean, example, I have a sister who lives in Rhode Island, and she was to say, yeah, we're pretty good. We only had only 800 deaths. And I says, well, how many people in Rhode Island? About 1 million. And then I told her, here in Oregon, we only had 148 deaths, and we have 4 million people, you know. So different areas are different. So when you start tallying up the numbers, I hate to see 300,000 people die by the end of this year. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Well, always good to hear from you, Harry. And 503-231-8187, if you want to talk to both me and the wider audience out there, or maybe I shouldn't say that. Just pretend you're talking to me in case you have any nervousness about calling in, which, believe me, I do. I call in occasionally to other shows, not generally KBOO, but sometimes the right-wing AM talk shows, and sometimes I try to get on. Actually, I don't think they have many call-in shows on NPR, the OPB station here. But anyway, I know how it is, but don't worry, you're just talking to me. 503-231-8187. Got anybody on stack, Sonia?
Not so far. Lines are open, folks, so you can jump right in. Oh, here we go. Hold on.
Okay, I'll let you take that call. And I just mentioned this new article by Tom Hartman, the next death wave from coronavirus will be the poor, rural, and white. Of course, that's making predictions is always difficult. But it's an interesting article. Worth checking out, it opens up so many fault lines. The fact that it's being politicized, I guess, was inevitable, but it is truly shocking that the whole science, the whole denialism that we're so familiar with in the whole climate change debate, has been sort of transferred immediately to the COVID-19, all the different fault lines in terms of political attitudes, cultural attitudes are being opened up, racial divides, as I mentioned earlier, it's truly mind-boggling. Let's go to our next caller, though.
We have Nathaniel. Go ahead, Nathaniel. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. I'm an anthropologist, and demography is one of my specialties. And this is not to contradict, but to reinforce this issue about racial and poverty divide and how people are suffering from COVID. It seems to me we're making this a little complicated in some ways. I saw a map yesterday of COVID cases and COVID deaths per population, and it's clear that the coasts, including the St. Lawrence River and the Great Lakes, are the places where the COVID has struck the hardest, where the highest number of cases are recorded and the greatest number of deaths per population are being recorded. And obviously those are places with lots of poverty and lots of minority black and brown populations. And they're also the places where the major international facing airports are, Seattle, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C., and Miami. I guess it's Dallas rather than Houston. So those are the places where COVID came into the country through those big airports. And those are the places that have dense urban populations, New York, Chicago, Detroit, whatever. And those are the places that are getting slammed. So from some point of view, the issue about where COVID showed up and where it's hit the hardest is a pure demographic issue. It's about where people are exposed to international air travel, where they live most densely, and where they're poorest. And it's interesting because Oregon's right in the middle between Washington and California, and our rates are pretty high per population, but they're nothing compared to either Washington or California. So even before you get to medical issues and issues of racism and slavery and poverty, we have these other issues of international air travel and dense populations of poor people that I guess they're the accelerants on the fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no, I was it's interesting that when I sort of fell into this myself stupidly, that a lot of people were saying, oh, it's a equal opportunity virus that a fair number of more wealthy white people were getting sick, but of course that was because they're the international travelers. But then as they seeded the virus, it obviously started to spread, and I think that follows. The subject I brought up follows along with that now that it's starting to seed everywhere because people still do travel, it goes from person to person to person to person, and so now it's showing up everywhere, and so it's going to be, the theory is, and it seems to be bearing out, is that the places where people have most conscientiously either by law or dictate from above and or by people following it, which I think people in Oregon, or at least Portland by and large, have been doing, following the social distancing, it clearly is shown to slow down the spread of the virus. And it's so corollary is where people are not following that, and I guess it's going to take days and weeks to see if that truly bears out, the people flocking to the beaches, the lakesides, the clubs, the private parties. It seems like that's going to be where it starts to spread more.
Yeah, some of that will depend on how much virus there was there to begin with. when an organism is introduced into an environment, it's called a propagule. And the density of propagules, that is simply how many of them show up, you know, or brought in, is one of the factors on how well the organism establishes itself in the environment. So some of that will matter. But I think where people live most densely is always going to be more of a problem than where people congregate, you know, for the weekend most densely. We, as you say, we'll see about whether these periodic, you know, congregations really do make a difference. But one of the things about the map and the story that accompanied it is, it's that blue states are where the problem has been so far, because they are the coastal states and they are the densely populated states. So there's been a real distinction in direct experience between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats live in the places where the virus has been the most devastating so far.
And so that feeds into the sort of the Republicans tending perhaps more extremely towards this strange sort of exceptionalism ideology. So maybe they've been thinking they're accepted from it. I don't know. That's sort of just came to mind. I don't know. I know that ideology is very widespread in the United States in general. We tend to believe that about ourselves in general, but certainly, I think it's fair to say that given the Republicans espousing of more strongly of this strange so-called free market neoliberal ideology, they seem to be the foremost proponents. Although obviously the corporate Democrats are close second. Well, anyway, those are very interesting observations. I think we're so thoroughly inundated by this thing that we can only but think it through the best we can.
Yeah, I'd just like to say one more thing before getting off is that ideology is not uncorrelated to experience. I mean, people may get confused, and in our country we deliberately confuse people about the meaning of their experience, but there are connections, and I don't know if this is really true, but it's been said a lot in recent years that racism is highest amongst people who are not exposed to other races, and that people have direct experience of black and brown and white and red and yellow people are less racist. Again, this is people, if that's true, then maybe it's a parallel to people who have the most experience of people
especially
being really
especially if it's experience of more a peer type experience as opposed to maybe somebody just having an African-American work for them or something like that, or a Latino person work for them. But I think that's very true, and that's the problem, is that people tend to cluster in their bubbles, and ideology, as you see, ideology and experience tend to reinforce themselves.
Well, thank you for doing what you do. I appreciate everything about KPOO.
All right, and thank you, and I hope, well, sorry to put you on the spot, but I hope you are also have supported or will consider supporting KBOO, as I said earlier. But anyway, thank you for the call. Most importantly, I appreciate your joining in the conversation at 503-231-8187. We've heard from Harry and Nathaniel, and whoever you are that's listening can also call up that number and join the conversation.
In fact, Paul, we have James on the line. James, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted you to comment on something you had mentioned earlier in the program, and that is the recent statement by Joe Biden on the talk radio show where he had commented that as a black person, you would have to be insane.
He said, you ain't black if you vote for Trump.
Right, exactly. you quoted the correct words. And I think that you know, that's offensive, and I think that the media gave considerable attention to the fact that speaking to people what their identity is and whom they should vote for by the color of the skin is particularly offensive. But what I think is even, you know, an equal concern here is that this is not just something that, you know, reflects on Joe Biden's personality or way of thinking. I think this is something that is endemic within most of the ranks of the Democratic Party. And that is that the Democratic Party feels that they are not just supported by people African American background, is that they're entitled to their votes. And, you know, this has been a horrible electoral strategy. The one time that we've won, the Democratic Party has won elections in the presidential arena over the past 20 years has been when Barack Obama was running, and of course he was an African American candidate, and that was largely because of a large turnout of African American voters. So whereas, you know, the African American contingency has largely supported Democrats and to a very high extent over, you know, the past three or four decades, the turnout has not always been there. And the fact that, and I think the statement that was more indicative and to me also very offensive was that his belief that, you know, you ain't black if you're going to vote for Trump was based upon the fact that he said, well, you know, I've supported the renewal of the Voting Rights Act. That is the minimum. That's the minimum that any presidential candidate or any political candidate should do for African American people. The fact that the Democratic Party has not advanced a platform which has done anything to bridge the wealth gap, which has increased since the 1970s between African Americans and white Americans, is particularly troubling. And I think that's something that's gone unaddressed and that really addresses, you know, real issues issued faced by that voting population instead of just the kind of superficial support by voting, you know, extending the renewal of the Voting Rights Act, which is, you know, supporting their right to vote. Nothing
right, and,
more,
and,
really.
And the Democrats have been really feeble on much stronger measures on actually making it, as I said earlier, of increasing access and guaranteeing access. They've been remarkably feeble on strongly standing up. Anyway, so yeah, it's not to mention mass incarceration and so many other things. You're totally right about that. I agree. It's the idea that he was Obama's VP and somehow that sort of rubs off on him, I guess is maybe partly what he's thinking too, in addition to, yeah, I mean, he certainly is getting the sort of legacy support, at least from the sort of the institutional black leadership in general. And, you know, that has been almost a given. But just the arrogance of that statement is truly breathtaking. And it just goes, I mean, I was thinking about that. I was thinking, I mean, that's kind of thing you could think maybe like a college student who's sort of trying to, sort of a braggadocio, trying to, you know, sort of make it seem like they've sort of like got a sort of street sensibility. They might say something stupid like that. But a candidate for president, I mean, no matter what his, you know, potentially diminished mental capacity or whatever, you'd think it would be ingrained in him to like avoid. You think alarm bells would go off in his mind as he started to edge towards thinking of saying something like that, but apparently not. Maybe the filters are just off. I don't know.
Well, thank you for your response.
Okay, and thank you for your call. And I thought again I can't remember his name. The man who was on with Amy Goodman said the most pertinent thing I've heard said about it is not that Biden's not just running against Trump; he's running against himself for, as our last caller just said, for the vote. You know, the kind of vote that came out for Obama that hadn't come out for other candidates of whatever party or for whatever kind of office that he brought out. The youth vote, he brought out more women, he brought out way more African-Americans, especially younger, and those are the kind of people that Biden crucially needs, and exactly the kind of people that he's going to turn off by making such a statement, which is truly unfortunate, since for now he's who's running against Trump. And as my guest Norman Solomon said a few weeks ago, that it truly is a grim contest between sort of a continuation of the old neoliberal order versus this, I would say uncharted, but unfortunately is being charted as they go along, this strange hybrid sort of neo-fascistoid, hyper-neoliberal, total unregulation, whatever this Trumpism represents, which to me is nothing good, is still it seems like there's a presumably some more sanity in what Biden has to offer, but I don't know. What do you think? 503-231-8187, that's the number to call in to talk to me, Paul Rowland, the host of Wednesday Talk Radio. And we only have 25 minutes to go.
Well, we've got a couple of we've got a couple of folks lined up. First is, we've got Mark and George. First up is Mark, if you're ready.
Yeah, let's hear from Mark.
Okay, Mark, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Bernie Sanders is truly the candidate we need to reverse the fascist destruction and the generalized mistrust and cynicism of the people. He said the other day that we should moderate our criticism of Biden. We have to get rid of this sociopathic megalomaniac. Those are Noam Chomsky's words. I absolutely agree. Now, I'm interested in your ideas about a 3-day or 4-day work week. Now, this would be a leftist response to the unparalleled economic crisis that we are in now. 40 million households have lost one or more jobs. That's a quarter of the workforce. We were already in a massive crisis before the epidemic, with corporate debt actually reaching $9 trillion in November of 2019. The Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats have done two good things recently. They eliminated a $135 billion giveaway to millionaires as part of the Corona relief. And they canceled the first $10,000 of student loans. Now, it's amazing to me how the corporate media ignores the economic crisis and accepts a very bland kind of reporting where the emphasis is on weather updates. What do you think about a leftist 4-day work week?
I think the same thing I think about other similar proposals, that first you got to get into a position to be able to propose and pass and implement
right.
Such a thing. So that seems to be the first step. I personally think we have to completely rethink. I'm anti-capitalist. I think the whole idea of making profit off of labor and resources is against the natural system of things personally, and against our humanity. And yeah. So I think that's a start. I think that we have to totally rethink the whole idea of work, productivity, production, so many things we have to rethink. But yeah, sure, I'd be in favor of that. But again, yeah, my response is always the same. You know, you and what army or what Congress or what set of forces
right.
is going to be able to actually, you know, propose, pass, right. and implement such a proposal.
So the idea of a rent strike, a mortgage strike until the epidemic ends, is still in dreamland. We don't have a way to go from A to B. You're absolutely right. People should be the criteria, not profit. And we have to prophetically criticize the abuses of the system, how public interest is subverted and private and special interests are applauded and encouraged. You know, we should close the tax havens. We should eliminate stock buybacks, insider trading. So thanks for your passion. We need a long breath. We need to live 1,000 years, I think.
Bernie
has 40% of the delegates. So let's see what happens, and maybe Biden will drop out. That would be very sensible. Sensible things often happen in Canada, not in America.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can imagine a necessarily a better candidate being offered up by the rulers of the Democratic Party, but it is interesting that Sanders still has 40%.
Yes.
40% of the delegates is an interesting fact.
Yes, absolutely. So thanks for your passion.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing a few more callers in the last 20 minutes that we have. It's 8:40 in the morning. My name's Paul Rowland. I'm your regular host here on Wednesday Talk Radio. I usually have a co-host or a guest with me. I'm flying solo today, so it's kind of open phones for you. And I think we have another caller that might be George, is that?
Yeah, Paul, it's me, George.
Hey, George, what's happening?
Well, I'm reading a little bit about vaccines, and I certainly do favor the idea of a vaccine for this dreadful epidemic. And in one of the books I was reading, I saw something about two earlier attempts, and I think probably everyone listening probably has television and knows about these two events, and I'm sure you do too, but I've had forgotten about them. But there were two earlier problems in the 1950s and maybe in the 70s with, I think, the Salk vaccine had some problems, and I don't know, a few people got polio from it and got paralyzed, I think, and died, but it wasn't a lot of people. But then I read, and I have a book, and I hesitate to just name numbers over the air because people will say, well, that might be, those numbers are probably wrong. But what I have read is that during the swine flu epidemic, a vaccine was put together, and there were some problems with it. And I've heard something like over 600 people had serious problems, and some were paralyzed. So what I'm hoping is that if they are going to put a vaccine together, they will do some. And I just worry that they are going to rush into this, but I...
Yeah, no, I thought maybe that's where you're going. I mean, I think, you know, since Trump is involved and there's an election coming up, obviously he's, you know, what did he call it? Operation Warp Speed is this grand project that he's got with all these corporados on board. And, you know, the fact that they paid, what, $1 or $2 billion to a multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical firm as the one that they're supporting on this is very suspect. And the fact that he does have a political interest in trying to trot something out that at least seems to work initially. I mean, if he could get something out before the election that seems to have positive results, I mean, that would be a dream situation. And, you know, and I wouldn't put it past him to try to, you know, not that he or whoever's developing the vaccine can engineer it in such a precise way that might be the result. But yeah, I mean, I think everybody studying this, everybody, you know, all the vaccine specialists are way, you know, at least the ones who aren't working for corporations, are way more cautious about the time. And, you know, I think caution is definitely in order.
Isn't it one of the standard things that they, once they have what they think is probably a good vaccine, that they need to test it on a relatively small group, not like a million people, but I don't know how many, we say like maybe 100 volunteers, or tested on, they used to test it on different.
Yeah, that's phase one. And there's already, I think, a couple, there's one that already did phase one, which is, I think, the mm-hmm. the company that I just mentioned earlier that had received the federal subsidy from Trump. And that got a lot of headlines. I can't remember the name of it offhand, but just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and have been featured prominently. This one guy who was in that initial study, mm-hmm. the phase one study in Seattle, has been on CNN with Anderson Cooper a lot. There, but yeah, I think there's another one that entered phase one. There's ten different firms that actually have started or are going to start phase one, and there's probably 10 or 15 others that are sort of in the pipeline, and they're all sort of racing against each other. But yeah, I mean, the idea that they can, you know, obviously it would be record time, even anything under a year and a half or 2 years or even 3 years, I think, would be record time for any vaccine. So, you know, the idea that they're talking about within this year or early next year shows that obviously there's a lot more resources. There's a lot more resources being put into it. There's a whole bunch of new technologies that are in development that have to do with, you know, various forms of genetic engineering, using the RNA, I don't really have it, you know, locked down in my head, but there's a lot of reasons why they actually are able to move faster, and why it does seem like there is more likelihood that they can come up with a vaccine in a shorter period of time. But still, there's a lot of things that can go wrong.
One question more. Will we be able to verify, we the public, that they have tested these? Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, will we the public be able to verify that they have done the pretests and get an accurate report on the pretests?
Well, judging from the ability of science to be well distributed and well understood and well assimilated by the populace in general is very minimal. So, what if you mean by one individual like yourself who has the time and ability to read into it?
Oh, that,
I presume that you might be able to, but I don't know. That's a good question. That's an important question.
We have to know, I think, that they've done the pretest, and we have to have something like vetted record by people who are independent experts of what the results were. Did anybody die? How many had serious problems? Or did it work, and how well? I'll get off the air now, but I'm glad thanks for giving me the time to just express my...
No, and I appreciate you bringing that up. That's really important. It points to a lot of the battlegrounds that are going on, and the war over science is probably going to heat up over the question of this vaccine. We definitely are just seeing the beginning of it. So thank you, George, for flagging that. That's a really important point. 503-231-8187. We've got only about 10 minutes left. So if you want to call in, you better do it right now and not wait till 5 minutes from now.
All right, we have Annalise.
Go ahead, Annalise.
Good morning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. It's a beautiful day. What I have been wanting to say for a few weeks now is that to change, to have an overhaul on the system, at least partly, we need, and that is not going to happen under Joe Biden. However, the taxing structure has to change completely. And then I heard this man in the Trump administration this morning say about the capital stock, people, capital stock, and because add $600 extra to their regular unemployment benefits, and those people might get lazy and don't want to get back to work. Let's start with that's what he said. Anyway, let's start with taxing the ultra rich. If we take $100 billion away from Bezos, from Amazon alone, he will still be a multi-billionaire. And let's start with that. And that will keep all the unemployed people with a fairly decent income, where they don't have to give up their housing and their livelihood or food for their children. And also,
well, that's why.
I also heard on Amy Goodman that there is only 15% of children that need food that regularly would get those meals in school. Only 15% of all those children get actually food, and there's a hunger in the United States, and that's an abomination outside of all the other atrocities. But let's start immediately in November with the tax change in the tax code. For instance, also when you
that would have to wait until January in case if a different candidate other than Trump ends up winning the presidency. But yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Well, nobody talks about that. Trump doesn't talk about that, of course. Nobody on the media I hear talk about it, that the tax structure has to change for the ultra-rich. I don't mind anybody being rich, but for instance, when people fill out unemployment papers, it says that the federal I don't know if it's state also, but federal income taxes of 10% can be withheld before you get that money. 10%. So people that earn $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year immediately already will get 10% taken off. That is not happening with the richest companies in this country. So that is my
Well, of course, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren certainly did talk about that, and we can see what happened to them, because obviously the Democrats are still tend to be largely controlled by the, you know, their corporate masters as well as the Republicans, and so it's a hard fight at any level.
Yeah,
I totally agree. I think a totally revamped tax structure is a minimal first step. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, have a wonderful day, and thank you for being there, Paul. Thank you.
Great. Thank. Always good to hear from you, Annalise. And we've got 6-7 more minutes. 503-231-8187. Yeah.
We have Sean.
Okay, let's
hear from
Sean.
Sean, are you still with us? You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul.
Hey, Sean.
Paul, first I want to acknowledge the horror of the murder in broad daylight in Minnesota. I think that's a visible form of what goes on every day, not just with the wealth gap, the racial wealth gap, the disproportionate numbers of incarceration, the premature deaths from easily preventable diseases, diabetes, heart disease, hypertension. So that was like a visible murder right out in broad daylight, but that goes on every day, as you know, I'm sure. And, you know, I was watching Matt Taibbi and Katie Halper the other day. They had a guest on, Jimmy Dore, and they were talking about how the so-called CARES Act represents the greatest upward transfer of wealth in the history of humankind. So folks got their little $1,200 payment, while Wall Street and the Fortune 500 got trillions and trillions of dollars. So I hope this fall, when the forbearances end, when people are going to have to pay car payments and mortgage payments and rent payments, when there's no more forbearance and those balloon payments are due, the poor people of this country, the working class people of this country, of all races, when the state services are being slashed, because you know what they're going to claim. They're going to claim there's no revenue, so all of the programs that people have come to rely on are going to be facing huge cuts. We are going to need each other. We are going to have to be in solidarity with one another as a class like never before. I don't know what that's going to look like, a general strike, a rent strike, but I've never seen, I mean, the shock doctrine doesn't really begin to describe the power grab that's going on, the transfer of wealth and power. And, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, Paul. Like, I hear the term essentialism thrown around, identity politics, intersectionality. We have got to come together as poor and working class people. Obviously, the political system is completely dysfunctional and broken. It's not going to happen there. So in the face, this fall, with the rebound of the virus, the end of the forbearances, there's got to be a blanket shutdown. What do you think, Paul, in terms of kicking some of those ideas around?
I don't know what to say. You've said it admirably. I guess my initial response, perhaps somewhat flippant, to would be almost the same as the early caller asking me what I thought of a 4-day work. Well, you and what army? I mean, you and solidarity. The kind of solidarity that you're talking about is the kind of solidarity that we've largely lost and has been eroded through this process. And how we get it back in the middle of a crisis, I don't know. I hate to be bleak, but
right. I mean, we've been so siloed. The single issue politics, the siloing of politics, the lack of class consciousness. I think, you know, people of color are right to be wary of Caucasians talking about solidarity. Right. I totally get that. I totally respect that, because it was, you know, in the post World War II period, the New Deal was not shared, you know, equally amongst all the races. There was redlining, there was discrimination of all kinds, so I totally get the skepticism, you know, but there's got to be some degree of class solidarity.
We only have like 2 minutes left. I just got this Facebook message from an indigenous compatriot up in Canada who has said that I hope that if a policeman has their knee on my neck and is killing me, someone acts to de-arrest me. And it was really striking, because I mean, what would I do in a situation where I saw, you know, even if there's a bunch of me and a bunch of people, even some people I knew, what would we do if we saw somebody like
killing? Right, the man in a uniform has got a pistol on his belt.
I would be tempted to take off my shoes and start throwing
things at the cop, but then I'd probably get shot myself, you know.
I know. I don't want to say that that's a metaphor for the general situation, but it is certainly a grim reminder. But on the other hand, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 4 cops wouldn't have been fired. So, I mean, they're, you know, and you wouldn't have had the mayor of Minneapolis virtually in tears. I mean, those are, I don't want to minimize those. I mean, I think it is somewhat superficial, but it's somewhat heartening to see. But I think we've pushed up against the limits of our time, and it's always refreshing to hear you speak your truth, Sean.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate your program, and thank you so much for everything you do.
All right. Well, the little care that I'm able to do, this platform that I hope I use effectively. I guess I just want to make one more appeal to you, the listener. We are a listener-sponsored station. Have been for over 50 years now, by gosh, and we're keeping it going through this pandemic thanks to our hardworking staff and volunteers and our board operator Sonia and all the others who do that for us And thing you can do if you haven't yet, if you have a few dollars to throw our way, I think we're a few thousand dollars short. We had to cancel our spring membership drive, as I say, which is a key fundraising element. And we still have a goal, and we are several thousand short of that goal. So I would encourage you to go to kboo.fm and click on donate to the extent that you are able, or send it in to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. All right. Thanks again, Sonia, and thanks to everybody who listened, and I'll talk with you next week.